that now.
Okay.
Today is July 18th, 2012. This is Dominic Mores, a graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin, the H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports, as part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project. I am interviewing Ron O'Brien over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. All right, now that that's out of the way, first of all, it's a really great honor to talk with you. I mean, your background is decorated, and it's congratulations on all your accomplishments. That's really amazing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. What precipitated this project?
Well, the Stark Center here, it started off as more of like physical culture and sport, and kind of we get a lot of artifacts and books and everything just chronicling that information, and then it was also deemed an Olympic Research Center. We were bestowed that honor, and so from that we're doing stuff to really enrich that Olympic history, and so this falls into that mission.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's actually really, really cool. We a lot of people are excited about it, and we have a lot of people helping with it. So it's really a good time. And you're the second person that I've interviewed, so this is still new to me, and it's fun. So it's fun either way. But okay, I'll just start off. If you could give me a little bit of information about, you know, your earlier years, where you were born, when you were born, what kind of got you into, you know, the sports you started off with.
Okay, I'm a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was born there March 14th, 1938, and I lived there until I was 17. And the thing that got me involved with aquatics was I lived about 3 or 4 blocks away from a YMCA that had a swimming pool.
Mm.
And a rudimentary, by today's standard, diving board. And I got involved in, learned to swim first, and then I graduated to swimming on the team when I was about, I think, 9 or 10. And then I eventually graduated into doing some form of diving. Well, it was pretty raw at that point.
Mm-hmm.
The boards weren't very good. The pool was shallow. The roof ceiling of the pool was low, so you could basically go from the diving board and touch the ceiling and hit the bottom in about a second and a half. And I participated in swimming and diving all the way through high school, mostly as a swimmer. But then when I graduated from high school, or was about to graduate, and realized I was 5'2" and weighed 108 pounds, I didn't think I was going to be a really good swimmer, because I was behind from the start.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Ohio State University on a work trip. They didn't have scholarships in those days. I went on a work plan where they would help you get a job to pay your expenses. And
mm-hmm.
I became a diver at Ohio State. And I got into coaching because the coach that I had at the YMCA was a really dynamic person.
Mm-hmm.
And I was originally going to be an engineer, but then I decided I wanted to be a teacher and a coach because of his influence. So when I went to Ohio State, that was my goal.
Oh, okay. So you changed, once you got to college, that's when you changed your mind about what you wanted to do with life.
Yeah, the summer before I went to college is when I made that change. I decided I didn't, as an engineer, I'd be working with figures and statistics and things like that, and I decided I really wanted to work with people.
That makes a lot of sense. That resonates pretty much with me. Did you also, I thought I read somewhere and reading a little bit about you, that you participated in gymnastics?
Yes, at Ohio State I did for 3 years.
Okay, did that, and I was reading a little bit, and diving and gymnastics, they complement one another?
Yes, probably not as much today because there's so much required to be able to do either sport that you can't do both. But back in those days, you could.
Mm-hmm.
trampoline. I did trampoline, floor exercise, and tumbling, and especially the trampoline and tumbling were complementary to diving.
Oh, awesome. So you mentioned a little bit about your coach at the YMCA as being an influence. Did you have what was your family or friend support like, you know, going into college and then on your path to becoming a coach? Was it supportive? Did you have people that were maybe a little bit against it, thought maybe you should think it over again, or how did that work?
My family was very supportive. I was the first person in my family to get a college degree. My dad was a fireman, my mom was a housewife, and there wasn't a lot of money, but whatever they could spare, they would help me get through college, and I was working about 24 hours a week and going to school and training at the same time.
Wow.
They would come to the events whenever they could, but finances were a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But they were very supportive.
Awesome. So let's move on a little bit, because we're going to focus mainly, you know, on the 68 games, because this is what it's about. What the year before the games, what did life look like for you? I mean, working, coaching, you know, training athletes. How did what was that year like?
Well, I was at Ohio State University as the diving coach then.
Mm-hmm.
And I was selected to be the head coach of the 1967 Pan American Games.
Okay.
That was my first international experience as a coach.
Awesome.
Which was totally unexpected, because I had had some success coaching prior to that, but never had been on an international trip.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was in, I think, like August of 67. And then when it came to the 68 games, I wasn't a candidate to be a head coach, because there were other coaches that were way ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
In what they had done and the athletes that they were coaching. So I ended up being the assistant coach and manager. Actually, I think the first manager for an Olympic diving team.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because prior to that, swimming really was in charge.
Okay.
And swimming would control everything for diving, and the budget was all with swimming, and diving would get some of that budget. But in 1968 was the first time that they separated out money from the Olympic Committee, where diving had its own budget and swimming had its own budget.
Oh, wow.
I was in charge of taking care of the money. Of course, I had to report back to swimming, because it was still kind of under their umbrella, but they cut the cord and let us kind of do our own thing for the first time.
Mm, okay. So what I'm curious what other responsibilities the manager entailed. Were you able to help with coaching at all with that, or what else could you do?
I did some coaching, but not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I was an assistant, so if the head coaches were working with the rest of the team and one of the divers needed some help on some area, and I would take them off to the side and work with them and then send them back over. But I didn't really have any charge of what was going on. I didn't set training schedules, mm-hmm. training times, anything like that. I managed the money, and I helped the head coaches whenever they asked for it.
Okay. How long did the players get to work with you before the Olympics?
Well, that was probably one of the longest training periods of any games, I think, because of the altitude at Mexico.
Oh, okay. We're going to talk about that anyway, so go ahead and elaborate.
Well, we went to the U.S. We trained at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And we stayed at, I'm trying to remember the name of the resort out there. It's got two great golf courses. Maybe it'll come to me. It's been a while since I thought about it. But we were there for, I think, 5 weeks.
Wow.
Of training to adapt to altitude. And then we went to Mexico City, and we were there for 3 weeks before the games.
Wow.
So we were 2 months on the road, and in fact, we went directly from the Olympic trials, which were held in Long Beach, California, to Colorado Springs, never went home. I had intended to go home, and then I ended up becoming the assistant coach and manager, and I remember I was going to take my family home, but we ended up driving to Colorado Springs, and then my wife drove the rest of the way home to Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
So we were basically an 8-week training camp, which is a long time, and I don't know that athletes and coaches today would want to do that. But, we didn't want to get caught on the short end of altitude when we got to Mexico City.
Right. So you said you were married at the time. Did you also have children, or was it just you and your wife?
No, we had two children.
Oh, boy, awesome. And a girl. Awesome. Were they young at the time, so it was more like almost trying to make it a family vacation, I guess?
Yeah, they would have been 5 and 8.
Oh, okay. That's great. So how did I'm curious what the selection process is for coaches for these international games.
Well, it's changed over time. It used to be selection. I think originally it was selection through the U.S. Swimming Organization. Then it evolved to selection through U.S. Diving. After 68, I believe 68 was the last time that the coaches were selected by the swimming committee.
Oh, wow.
And in 72, it was done by the diving committee, U.S. Diving.
Wow, so it seems like 68 wasn't just important as a whole, but I mean also for your particular sport, the aquatic sports as well. It seems like that was a huge change in a lot of the ways that things worked for you and the diving.
Yeah, I think it was the Y in the road where swimming, who used to be in total control, was starting to give control over to diving. And let us do more of our own thing.
Okay.
Because between 68 and 72, and I could be wrong because it's been 44 years, but I believe swimming had control of the selection process in 68 and handed it over to U.S. Diving by 72. And then I think splitting the budget out and making me the first manager for diving was a move in the direction of giving diving some independence.
Oh. Do you have any idea what precipitated this change or what caused it?
Honestly, no.
Okay.
I just think some of the people in charge of USA Swimming at that point started to think that diving needed to have its own identity. And they probably had an influence on the Olympic Committee because it's a pretty big sport in the Olympics.
Right. That makes sense. So what about the Olympic trials, the 68 Olympic trials? Can you, were any big problems or challenges or ups and downs faced by people or any highlights that really stick out to you?
Not in the trials itself. I think the people that should have made the team made the team. There weren't any real controversies that I remember. It was a very smooth running event. The correct people got on the team. There was nothing in the 6 day trials that I can remember being of any impact.
I'm curious because, you know, you've done a lot with the Olympics. Let's just put it that way. Is it hard for you to? Is it a blur sometimes with all the games that you think about, or are you still able to remember and separate those memories pretty well?
Yeah, I think I can separate them out pretty well.
That's pretty awesome to be able to do that because you've.
Each one's been different.
Right. Right. I've never been, so I just figured I'd ask.
Well, 68 was. I was a real neophyte. I had not been to the Olympic Games before that, and so that was my first experience.
How did the people around you react when they realized, you know, that you had been hired as assistant coach? And was that a huge deal for your family and friends and people you worked with at Ohio State, or was it, you know, was it kind of nonchalant? Well, that's great, you know, good luck to you.
No, it was a big deal. It was a big surprise because I had not been in a position like that before. I had no clue that that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even sure how it happened or why it happened because I wasn't present when the decision was made.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume that the swimming people decided that there should be a manager and assistant coach for diving, and that the two head coaches, Dick Smith and Hobie Billingsley, probably had an impact on who that was going to be.
Oh, well, that's awesome. Did you have relationships with those people before, or did they just know who you were?
Oh, no. I had been a coach since 1962, and had been at the Nationals as an athlete from 1955, and I'd known them for 13 years.
Oh, awesome. Well, it always
and
helps.
Hobie Billingsley was my nemesis at Indiana because I was the coach at Ohio State, and he was beating my butt.
Were you able to learn a lot being the manager with them?
Oh, yeah. That was a great influence on me because I got to watch what they were doing,
mm-hmm.
and how they did it and how they handled the athletes and how they handled the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a great observation post for me.
Did you take a lot? So I know that you have, I've seen a DVD, and I know that you have at least one book that you've published on, you know, training techniques with diving. Did you take a lot from them, I guess, not necessarily copy and paste, but did they influence a lot of what you do, or were you able to see and say, okay, this works, this doesn't work, or did they seem to have it figured out by that time?
Well, between 1968 and when I wrote that book in 1989 or whatever, there was a lot of biomechanical influence taking place. But I did. I learned a lot about coaching from watching them.
Mm-hmm.
Hobie Billingsley was very into the laws of motion and Newton's theories, and used it in his coaching, which impacted me. Dick Smith was more of an authoritarian coach.
Okay.
So I got to look at two different styles of coaching.
Wow.
But there was a lot of science that occurred in the next 20 years.
Got it. Okay, so what about the actual methods and things that you would do in preparing? We talked a little bit about the altitude. Would you just have practice regularly, but just at a higher altitude? Or did you modify things to address those altitude issues?
Well, as I remember, when we went to the Air Force Academy, initially the training load was lower and then gradually increased as the divers got used to the altitude. And diving's not what you would call, you know, physical sport from the standpoint of running a 1,500 meters or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do 100 dives a day and you're climbing ladders and stuff like that, it does have an impact.
Definitely.
So it was a gradual breaking in process through the period of time we were at the Air Force Academy.
Awesome. That's...
And then by the time we got to Mexico, there was no no problem with altitude. Everybody was adjusted.
Great. Do you know if y'all were one of the few that did that, or were many sports doing that, or do you have any idea? Did you talk to other coaches, or?
Well, I believe, although I can't verify this, that a lot of sports did that, especially the aerobic sports.
Right. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about. Or we're going to move on to the actual Olympic Games. We're curious about the Olympic Project for Human Rights and Harvard Crew Letter. Do you remember anything about that, or the possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. team?
No.
Okay.
Refresh my memory. Maybe I'll remember.
Well, it was a little bit about, because I don't necessarily remember or know all of it, but it had to do with, I'm pretty sure it had to do with the John Carlos and Tommy Smith. They gave them an actual, like the Harvard crew had a patch that they wore on their uniforms. If it's not ringing a bell to you, that's fine, because it's, you know, these aren't right or wrong answers, but...
No, I remember the Carlos and Smith situation, but I wasn't aware of anything to do with the rowers.
Okay. Okay. So what about the? There was a massacre. It's a few days before, 10 days before the start of the games. And seeing as y'all were there in Mexico City, do you remember much about those protests and violence there?
Oh yeah.
Could you?
That was the first time. Politics and the games just came head to head.
Really?
30 students were massacred in the square.
Mm.
And then for the rest of the games, there were tanks, automatic weapons, soldiers, all over the place.
Really?
Yeah. That was the start of the change of the Olympic Games, in my opinion, because I hadn't been to the games before that, but I followed them. And there weren't any incidents like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was. There's always been politics in the Olympics. You know, the IOC or whoever you talk to says, "Well, politics and the Olympics are not intermingled."
Mm-hmm.
That's baloney. If you read the history of the Olympic Games, it's always been that way.
Yeah, we actually. Took a class, an Olympic class, last semester, and one of the guys had been part of the Olympic movement, and we learned a little bit about that.
Yeah, so, well, yeah. It was true way back in the, you know, 1500, when the games were going on, it was they stopped wars, but there was still politics.
Yes, sir. So what about, how did that affect... With those massacres and tanks and everything, did that affect the way you and or the athletes went about, you know, your everyday activities? Or, I mean, was it in your head, or it was just once you were there, you're in the zone, nothing else matters? How did that work?
No, it didn't affect our participation in the games, but every time you would get on a bus or go somewhere and you would see tanks on the corner,
mm-hmm.
and armed military people, it definitely affected my view of the Olympic Games as being a peaceful event.
Mm-hmm.
It was no longer a peaceful event.
Right. What about the just the people of Mexico City, other than, you know, that military presence? What were your impressions of that and the city and just that culture? How was that?
Oh, it was wonderful. The Mexican people were great. The games was very relaxed, other than the fact that there was a military presence. But the village was surrounded by about a 5 or 6 foot high fence with no barbed wire or anything.
Mm-hmm.
The people would come to the village day after day trying to get autographs outside the fence, and the people running the games, the people at the venues were very easygoing and very positive.
Mm-hmm.
There were no metal detectors at that point. They didn't search your bag when you went in for training. It was very different. It was very, very relaxed.
Wow. Were y'all able to, after practices or before practices or days off, were y'all able to go out and sightsee and try to see any types of ruins or do any touristy types of things?
Yeah, we did all that.
Do you remember any of them that you did? We're curious.
Well, the pyramids and eating lunch, I think, in the cave, which is right, La Cava or something like that, right by the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go into the city and do some shopping and things like that. Yeah, we were.
Oh, wow.
We were mingling as much as we could and still maintain our training schedule.
Awesome. Were you able to bring your bring your family at all?
My wife came.
Awesome.
That was her first Olympic Games.
Wow, that's really cool. So what about in the Olympic Village? What were your accommodations like? Do you remember who you stayed with, where you stayed, and just the overall experience of staying in those dorms, for lack of a better word?
Well, they were dorms. There's no way around that. We were in bunk beds. The three of us, Hobie, Billingsley, Dick Smith, and myself, were all in one room. And the athletes were in a different area.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't all living together, which is the way it is today.
Mm.
So the coaches were separated from the athletes,
mm-hmm.
and the men and the women athletes were separated, which isn't really, I don't think, the way it happens today.
Mm-hmm. I've heard.
Apartments
heard
and
some things.
So kind of cohabitate, so it's a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
It was Spartan.
Really?
Yeah, we had community shower, community bathrooms, and we all slept in one room.
So
the three of us.
So kind of like a village.
Yeah, definitely.
What about
the village wasn't anything what it's like today, because today you've got all the interactive games, you've got weight training facilities, you've got everything. It's like a city.
Wow.
Back then it was going to be low-cost housing after the games were over.
Mm.
So it was basically small apartments.
Okay.
We didn't have a lot of ancillary activities going on. You lived in the village, you slept in the village, you went to the pool, and other than that, I don't remember a whole lot of other things going on in the village.
Okay. What about the food? Did anyone, was it good? Did anyone have problems with it or get illnesses or just not sit well with them? How was that?
I think the food was good. It was all brought in. It wasn't Mexican as far as, like, we're eating tacos and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember anybody getting sick. I think the food was not gourmet, but it was acceptable. You just can't make food when you're trying to feed a few thousand people.
Right.
Real gourmet.
Do you know if they had any, if they utilized any nutritionists at that time? Was it at that level, athletics at that level, to use nutritionists to give the athletes food?
Well, I'd have to double check this, but I believe the U.S. Olympic Committee, because of the fear of athletes getting sick, brought a lot of their own food in.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sure they had their own nutritionists, and I do believe that a lot of food was shipped in from the U.S.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Huh. So what about the opening ceremony? Were you there, or do you remember? We're actually even curious if you remember the column and row you were in. but if not that, just your overall general experience and how it felt to you.
Well, that's the only Olympics I marched in the opening ceremonies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I wanted to experience it at that point as my first Olympic Games. And I do remember marching in the stadium. I couldn't tell you what row or wherever I was, but I just remember the impact of walking into the stadium.
Really? How was that?
It was overwhelming to be a part of the USA team, and I think there were like 80,000 people.
Oh, wow.
Stadium, and it was very impressive. And I didn't march in any ceremonies after that because I felt like I had experienced it, and it started to get a little tighter as far as how many people could march.
Oh.
And so I felt the athletes deserved first choice.
Okay.
So after that, I just watched from the stands.
Got it. This may seem like an odd question after that one, but is that it seems like that could kind of be a philosophical way of coaching as well, you know, really putting your athletes first and everything. That also may seem kind of assumed, but is that part of your philosophy in coaching people? I mean, really making sure it's you know, all about the athlete and making sure that it's really, you know, the entire focus is them, and you are the back burner. You're in the back, just making sure that they're on their game.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Athletes have a limited lifetime.
Right.
And a lot of times with the Olympics, and back probably most times, they get one shot.
Mm-hmm.
As a coach, you have an extended career. You have more opportunities.
So, right.
Yeah, definitely. It's all about them, and they keep saying, the Olympic Committee keeps sending me stuff as an Olympian, and my philosophy is I'm not an Olympian.
Mm-hmm.
If I was an Olympian, I would have been diving in the games.
Right.
I was an Olympic coach, a staff member and whatever, but that's different.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be a line drawn there, I think.
Wow. That's really interesting. Okay, so what about what actual events? I'm not familiar with diving. I mean, I just say diving and that's all it comes to me. But from reading, are there three actual events? What, 1, 3 meter, and then platform? Is that correct?
Well, at that point in '68, there were only 4 diving events. So men's and women's 3 meter springboard and men's and women's 10 meter platform.
Okay. Okay.
As of 2000. Then there were 4 more events added when we added men's and women's 3 meter and 10 meter synchronized diving.
Oh, okay.
So we went from 4 to 8 events.
Awesome. Did you did the same coaches coach the women as well?
Well, I believe in '68 there was a men's coach and a women's coach.
Oh, okay.
And subsequently, I think in '72 it was the same, but by '76 it became a head coach and assistant coach, and there wasn't any separation as far as gender.
Okay, okay. So where
were... That didn't really mean... That was basically title only.
Really?
Yeah. The Olympic Committee designated a men's coach and a women's coach, but the coaches coached who they felt they could work with the best.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Were there, in this, maybe something you don't want to get into, and that's fine, but I'm just wondering, I've done some like strength coaching before, and I learned from, you know, some of my mentors, you know, they say, you know, not everyone's going to like you. You're not going to necessarily really get along with everyone that you coach. What was your experience with that? I mean, are there some people that really respond to you well and others that don't, or is, you know, once everyone gets to that level, they take what you say because they know they have to be the best?
No, I think there's definitely choice selection. As I remember in 1988 or 1968, that was part of the process. They talked to the kids about who do you want to work with.
Really?
Yeah. Both coaches had their own athletes on the team, but that didn't comprise the whole team. There were eight people, and Hobie Billingsley had two, I think. Dick Smith had two or three. And so that left anywhere from three to four other athletes that didn't have their coaches there. Dick Kimball had Mickey King on the team, and he came and basically sneaked into the games and coached, which you could do then. Now you end up in jail. And he coached her. But then there were two or three other athletes that had to decide, and between the athlete and their coach, prior to going to the games, they had decided who would work with who.
Okay. That's really cool. I had no idea about any of that.
There'd be nothing worse at the Olympic Games than being with the coach that you don't understand what they're saying or see eye to eye with. That's not the time to have a problem.
Exactly. Where were your diving events held, and when were they held? Early in the games or later in the middle?
You know, I don't really remember that, but I think it was pretty much early, and we used to go 4 days, 1 day break, four more days, so over a 9 day period of the 17 days or 16 days of the games.
Oh, wow.
Diving took place in it. I believe it was at the front end.
Okay. What about, did y'all do any last minute training or preparation that was, more focused on, you know, right before the competition, or was it more just, you know, easing back type of thing and peaking, is so to speak?
Yeah, easing back and peaking.
Okay.
I think some in some situations, coaches tend to want to get more intense as they get closer, and,
mm-hmm.
and my feeling is you need to do the opposite.
Right.
You need to get out of their way and let them do what they do naturally.
Mm-hmm. Can you just describe, you know, the competitions? What, anything that you can remember about, you know, who did well, or just what you remember about the actual events that occurred?
Well, one thing I remember is it's the first time a Soviet athlete got a medal.
Really?
Yeah. A girl got silver medal on 3 meter springboard. That was the first Soviet medal in diving, I think, ever in the games. And our athletes did well. We got first and third in the men's springboard, first and third in the women's springboard, third in the men's platform, and third in the women's platform. So we end up with 6 medals out of 12.
That'd be awesome. That's awesome in my book, but just getting to the Olympics would be awesome. So,
so it was a good games for us as far as medal count, because we started to drop after that.
Do you have any explanation why that you may have started to drop? I mean, obviously it wasn't coaching, because you started to take over after that, but. Did people begin to did diving become more popular in other countries after that, or?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
And the word that we dropped, I meant drop in medal count, because in Munich we only got 3 medals, lowest we'd ever gotten since about 1920.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't because we went down, it's because others came up, and Russia was coming on strong.
Ah, okay.
Russia and East Germany.
Oh, right. Well, that makes sense.
The communist influence on sport.
Yeah. But there weren't any controversies or anything like that in the 68 games that you can remember? Everything kind of went relatively smoothly?
Yeah, until Carlos and Smith.
Ah. Okay, well, I'm going to talk about that a little bit. I have a few other things I'd like to talk about, but we're going to talk about that too, if that's all right, a little bit later. So after the events, I mean, was it, did you go straight home, or did everyone go out, maybe have a tequila shot or two, or how did that work?
We had a team banquet.
Oh, really?
the night of the last event, which became a tradition in USA Diving.
Oh, awesome.
And it was in downtown Mexico City somewhere. I don't remember exactly where.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, everybody scattered.
Huh. Well, that's cool that you're able to bring everyone together and be able to celebrate, you know, all your hard work together. That's, I think, something like that is almost necessary.
Well, and now it's evolved into recognizing, at the banquet, recognizing each athlete and each coach and all the associated people, the USA Diving staff, the parents, family, they all attend.
Oh, that's really cool.
It's become a pretty traditional big event.
Awesome. Okay, so what about, we talked a little bit about women, but in 1968, they introduced the gender verification testing. Were you exposed to that at all?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I'm sure all our athletes were.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no controversy.
Okay. We talked about East Germany and the Soviets. Did you interact with any of these people at all?
Oh, yeah. The Olympic Games is not political when you get down to the participants.
Mm-hmm.
The political part of the Games is way up the ladder from where we are.
Yes, sir.
We knew the people somewhat at that point. We were friendly to some extent at that point, but if you go back to that period, there was not a lot of international competition in our sport. Might have been in track and field, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't travel around the world and compete against the different countries in 1968. We would only see those other countries basically once every 4 years. There weren't any world championships. There weren't any World Cup events. There were just starting, the U.S. started the first international, I think it was even after that. There weren't even any international invitational events.
Really?
So the only time we saw those people was on the pool deck, and we would say hi and we'd be friendly, but we really didn't know each other. Now, today, these people travel the world together. They're friends.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I wouldn't say we were friends.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't really know each other that well, but it was the start of a whole new era in diving, which occurred in the next few years, where international events were held in different countries. People went, traveled together, and got to be friends. But 68 was still kind of separation.
Right. That's cool. That's cool that you've been a part of that and been able to see the evolution of things like that. That's you seem to be a really great resource for all this stuff. Well, I'm going to move on and talk in a little bit about banned substances. Were you aware of that there was a list of them at the time that the athletes were not supposed to be using?
No.
Oh, wow.
Was there a list of banned substances at that point? I don't know.
Yes, sir.
We never had any in our sport.
Yeah. it's funny. I mean, it's colloquial, you know. You don't mention Olympics, it seems, without talking a little bit about it. But, yeah, at that time, I guess, you know, like a younger person like me would think, oh, yeah, I'm sure they just talked about it all the time. Don't do this, don't do that. But you weren't exposed at all to, warnings about banned substances or athletes doing steroids or anything like that?
Not that I can recollect.
Wow, that's really interesting.
It was a different era.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether there was a list of banned substances or not. I'm not sure there was.
Well, I think there was. Other than that, I couldn't tell you any more detail about it. But Yeah, because they also want to know in some of these questions that we have for you if you were aware that there was a Swedish pentathlete that was disqualified in 68 for it. So, I mean, I'm assuming that you didn't know about that, which is not, you know, not good or bad. It's just, you know.
Well, I don't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't – banned substances were not high on our – list of awareness at that point, at least in our sport.
Mm-hmm. What things were the divers supposed to be aware of at the time then, or you know, warnings about?
To my recollection, nothing except get a medal.
Yeah.
win a gold medal.
That makes sense. I mean, you worry about that and there's not much else you can get involved with, I guess.
Well, that was the mission, and since we weren't really involved with a sport where a banned substance would help you,
right?
It wasn't an issue in our sport.
Mm-hmm.
Like could be in weightlifting, track and field,
yes, sir.
Or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, those substances could be negatives, not positives.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, I'm going to ask a question that's probably more for me than it is anyone else. I'm really involved in strength and conditioning. I was a strength and conditioning coach for a while, you know, played football, really involved in weights. Did y'all use weights at all in y'all's training in 68?
I would say not much.
Mm-hmm.
I got my PhD at Ohio State in 1967.
Wow.
I did my master's work in 61, and I did almost all my study in exercise physiology area.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt that was an area of our sport that was totally neglected.
Yes, sir.
And I believe at that point I was starting weight training programs outside of diving.
Uh-huh.
And it was a very new concept.
Really? Did you encounter a lot of resistance?
No, because I was doing it with my own athletes at Ohio State.
Okay.
And we were doing really heavy leg training.
Mm-hmm. For more explosive type stuff, I guess, to come off the board?
Well, that came later. Actually, my first foray into that area was to develop leg strength, so we did a lot of heavy squats, leg
uh-huh.
presses, things like that, because that's the element you need in springboard diving.
Right.
Not so much speed with your legs, it's strength. You need to be able to push that board down and hold it.
Okay.
So that was my first initial move into that area. Then as I got a little more sophisticated, I got into platform diving. Is not so much strength, it's speed.
Mm.
So we did a lot of plyometric training, jumping, jump downs,
okay.
hopping up steps, things like that to increase the speed of being able to squat down and reverse your direction.
Yes, sir.
But back in 68, I would say probably nobody on our Olympic team did weight training.
Okay. Hmm. Well, that's cool. Now, you gave me a little history lesson there. That's really, really cool. I mean, like I said, that's my background, and so I always have to ask a little something about it.
Yeah, and we brought a lot of sports science and sports medicine people into our sport over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they do research. They do work with our athletes and pinpoint their strengths and weaknesses and develop programs for them. It's a lot different.
Right, right.
In 68, it was basically go to pool and dive.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about Smith and Carlos now. Were you there, and did you see that medal ceremony?
I was not in the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
I did see replays of it.
Okay. But you just heard about it through the grapevine, I guess?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I was not present.
Okay. What was your reaction to it at the time?
I thought it was wrong for the Olympic Committee to send them home.
Really?
Yeah.
And because
they had a right They had a right to test. It took a lot of courage.
Yes, sir.
And they suffered from it. But they brought a lot of attention to an issue that needed to be brought to the surface.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so you didn't fault them at all for what they did. Did you, was there any sort of, I guess, was there any sort of support from Olympians given to them, or were there even avenues for that to happen?
I can honestly say I don't remember a lot of discussion about it.
Mm-hmm.
My sense, being so many years from there, was it was kind of a taboo subject.
Okay, because I don't remember a lot of interaction, I guess.
Discussion about it. Just kind of, I think from the inside, the athletes and the coaches, just kind of a bit of a shock that it happened in a medal ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the other athletes and coaches thought, but I would think the athletes would have been supportive.
Okay. What about the response from media? Was it a huge hoopla?
Yeah, for that day, I thought. Of course, today it'd be 100 times worse.
Yeah.
We have, I think, more credentialed media people at the games than we have athletes now, or as many. So it's almost a toss-up.
Yeah, well, they couldn't have put it on their Twitter account that they did this a lot.
No, that's true. No, but I thought it was blown up quite a bit for that day and age.
Okay. Well, speaking of the media, what did you have many encounters with the media? And if so, what do you remember about it? I mean, were they usually good, bad, or I mean, just kind of get the facts and get out? How did that go?
Well, media contact at that point was pretty minimal.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first Olympic Games where any television was even involved was 1964 in Tokyo.
Mm.
I think back as much as 1960, you would get clips of things, but you didn't have the Olympic Games really on TV.
Okay.
68, because it was in Mexico, was an opportunity for our major network TV to get involved because it wasn't that far, and they could ship their equipment down there and get it set up.
Mm-hmm.
So the 68 Games was, as far as television, the most televised Olympic Games to that point.
Okay.
But the print media people, I don't remember much of them being around at all.
Hmm. Okay, well, the 68 Games, you know, there were a lot of, I guess, record-setting accomplishments that happened. Did you witness many of these? I mean, I know you said you had 9 days that you know, you were probably focused a lot on diving. But were you able to witness any other events, especially record-setting ones?
You know, in the 9 Olympic Games that I've been to as either a coach or a high performance director, I think I've seen 1 or 2 preliminary events of another sport.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You can't be a participant and be a spectator at the same time. It's very hard to do.
Yes, sir.
That's why I'm watching it on TV this time, so I can see it.
That'll be new for you, huh?
Yeah, you really don't. In a lot of cases, it takes quite a bit of transportation to get from one venue to another.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they do today, but it used to be if you had an athlete or coaching credential, you could get in any place. It was just a matter of having the time to carve out to get over to it.
Okay. Huh. I'm learning so much about the Olympics. All right, let's see what else. So anything, what about the closing ceremony? Did you attend that?
Good question. Hang on a second. Did we go to the closing ceremonies in Mexico City? I think we did. I think I went to one closing ceremony. I don't remember whether I did or not.
That's fine. That's fine.
The opening ceremonies made a great impact on me, but
mm-hmm.
I'm sure we probably did, but it wasn't the same.
Okay. So what about the 68 games sticks in your head as the most memorable part of it for you?
Well, it was the start of the change of the Olympic Games, in my opinion.
Okay.
Because of the student massacre.
Right.
Then followed by the Munich Israeli massacre.
Mm-hmm.
The games really changed direction totally. By the time we got to Montreal in 1976, there were 12-foot-high fences with barbed wire on the top.
Oh, geez.
Armed guards and dogs inside patrolling. You had to go through metal detectors. You had to open your bag and show everything you had every time you went into your venue. The Israeli athletes disappeared.
Really?
In all the other games I went to, I cannot really recollect seeing Israeli athletes in the village.
Huh.
They used to bring their food to their dormitory, which was always in a sort of off-the-corner area and a lot of security.
Jeez.
The whole game started to change, in my opinion, in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a lot of people think about the fact that there were 30 students killed
right
before the games.
Right.
And that there was a pretty strong military presence at that games.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate that in 1972 the PLO did what they did, because the Germans, in my opinion, were trying to make it a very peaceful, relaxed games.
Right.
To make up for the Second World War and the Nazis and mm-hmm. all that stuff. And that was all shattered.
Yes, sir. Yeah, we watched the film about that, and that's kind of the feeling that I got. That was their motivation for the relaxed atmosphere, but unfortunately, that, you know.
Yeah, it was shattered.
Yes, sir.
Actually, I went over that fence about 2 or 3 hours right before the Palestinians.
Wow.
Went over that, because we'd been downtown having a little celebration, and I didn't want to walk all the way around to the other side of the village, so I just climbed the fence.
Wow.
It's like a 5-foot-high fence.
Mm-hmm. That's heavy stuff, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Okay, so
and
after...
Now they spend $1 billion or $2 billion on security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's... Ugh. Wow. Okay, so after the 68 games, then, what, did you immediately go back to Ohio State and start working again? Or did you, were you able to have some time off, or how did that go?
Trying to remember when the games were in 68. I think they were in the fall.
Okay.
And so I had to go back. I had my college team to coach, so I had to go back. I'd been gone for a couple months. And
oh, wow.
Get started getting ready for the NCAA season.
Wow. Was there a huge, your support group, where did you receive, you know, a lot of congrats and celebration and a large reception when you returned?
Not that I remember. We all scattered to the hills, and it was every person for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to Ohio State and got back into my routine, and there was nothing more really said about it. But there might have been more of that with the two head coaches, because they had athletes that won medals.
Right.
And I did not, because I didn't have anybody on the team.
Okay. And then after that, did you, I guess, make it a point to try to become an Olympic coach after that? I mean, did you set your sights on that, or did you just try to make your college divers the best divers they could be? Or, I mean, how did that involvement in the 68 games kind of affect the way you looked at your career from then on?
Well, I tried out for the Olympic team in 56 and 60 as an athlete. I missed the team in 60 by one place.
Mm.
And I think it left me with a motivation to get back to the Olympics as a coach.
Yes, sir.
So I feel that 68 was a real stimulus for me after having experienced it,
mm-hmm.
to coach at that level.
Okay.
And so that really, although I was very focused on winning in Big Ten and NCAA championships and USA Diving national championships, the ultimate goal was to get people on the Olympic team.
Okay. So how, I know that you have a website. Could you talk a little bit about that and how else you're involved in diving at this point in time?
Well, right now my only I really don't have any involvement in an official capacity with USA Diving.
Uh-huh.
I have a website that is a service to the sport.
Okay.
Supported by Duraflex International Corporation, which is the company that makes the diving boards that are used worldwide for competition.
Okay.
And it's a free service for coaches and divers, because when I was coaching, and when I was high performance director for USA Diving, I would go around and do clinics, and I would constantly be asked by high school kids, their parents, and their coaches, where should my son or daughter go to school?
Mm-hmm.
And they really, the very top high school athletes that dive in USA Diving, they know where they want to go. The coaches know who they are. They don't really need help in the recruiting process. But there are thousands of other kids out there that aren't at that level,
mm-hmm.
But they're good enough to dive in a college program.
Right.
And so my website is designed as a free service to help those athletes and coaches a little further down the line, maybe Division I AA, Division II and III.
Mm-hmm.
NAIA, whatever, to make connection with each other.
I think that's really awesome, actually.
And hopefully it's working. I started out, let's see, 4 years ago, I had about 15 athletes on the website. Now it's up to about 500.
Oh, wow.
Which is a lot for a sport like ours.
Definitely. Definitely.
Hopefully kids and coaches are finding each other. Kids are extending their... Hello?
Yes, sir. I'm still here.
Extending their diving careers into college when they would have maybe quit.
Right.
And some kids are getting scholarships that wouldn't have otherwise gotten them.
Exactly. No, that's really admirable. I think that's a really great service that website provides. I think that's awesome.
And I realized I started out for it to be a for-profit.
Mm-hmm.
A deal, but I realized after a while my business model was not right, because you've got some really big recruiting services that do football, basketball, baseball, soccer, mm-hmm. track and field. They can charge a really low fee because they got a high number of athletes involved.
Right.
And in a small sport like ours, you just couldn't make a profit. Reasonable profit,
mm-hmm.
charging a small amount. So I decided, I'm going to outrun them and get a sponsor and make it free.
That's awesome.
So it's working out well.
That's great. Congratulations on that. That's really, really cool. That's a way to leave an effect on the sport. I think that's great. I have only a few more questions for you. What about... Were you ever exposed to rules or regulations involving amateurism? You know, like eligibility rules or gifts, payment for medals, and anything like that during 68?
No.
Okay.
It might have been something that would affect track and field or skiing or something like that, but at that point, no, it was not a factor at all in our sport.
Okay. Could you kind of compare and contrast that a little bit between then and now, if you know much about the amateurism now?
What amateurism?
Just
there isn't any.
Okay, well, that answers the question.
No, there isn't any. The athletes that are making our Olympic team, most of them have some kind of sponsor, mm-hmm. pays them. They have training fees, and the athletes today in our sport have to train. They want to be competitive. They have to train probably minimum 5-6 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
Or more, and that doesn't allow you to have a job, especially if you're out of college.
Right.
And so you need sponsor help in order to be able to be competitive. So,
yes, sir.
I don't believe there are any, or very few, true amateurs left anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If they're any good.
Right. Okay. I have maybe two more. Could you kind of compare, I guess, we've kind of talked about it a little bit, but some comparisons that stand out in your head to, you know, the 68 games and the other games that you've been to? I mean, I know you talked a little bit about politics and how that's become an even greater, involved much more within the Olympics. Are there any other changes that you can kind of see since 68?
Well, the saying over the years, because of the influence of the communist countries, first Russia, then East Germany, and more recently China,
mm-hmm.
Sport has evolved from where it used to be something you did in addition to the rest of your life to something you do instead of the rest of your life. it just, if you want to be competitive at that level, the amount of commitment is so great, it really has changed. Back in 68, we could train 3 or 4 hours a day, take a month or so off at the end of the season,
mm-hmm.
and start over again. But now they train 6, 7, 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. I think the Chinese train 7.
Wow.
You get 2 weeks off, and then you start over again. It really has, and I think it's the influence of politics in the communist countries trying to make sport make up for other things they didn't have,
mm-hmm.
changed the nature of sport. And the Olympic Committee rode right along on that wave because they didn't want to lose the medal count.
Right.
Or the gold medal count, and that's still a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the nature of sport has changed totally.
Yes, sir.
I mean, it's one thing if you're a football, basketball, baseball player, and you're making millions
mm-hmm.
to do that, but when you're in a sport where you're not making much of anything, and it takes that commitment, it takes a real motivated, dedicated person to do that, because I don't know any divers that have gotten rich.
Yes, sir. So then what about the 68 games as an effect on the world, not necessarily sport, but do you think that it had any significant changes on more like a cultural or social standing internationally or even nationally?
Well, I believe that the Carlos Smith incident definitely had an impact. I don't know about worldwide, but maybe had a worldwide impact on their view of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely had an impact on the United States culture.
Yes, sir. Okay, I just have two more questions, and I really appreciate your time. What about anything in part of the 68 games that kind of changed or significantly impact, you know, your life? I mean, is there something that might not have happened? If something didn't happen, you don't think you'd be where you are today, or was it part of what you needed? I know that it seems like, from what you've told me, that miss at the 1960 games is really what set you on your path. And then 68 was almost like a springboard into that. Is that a correct assessment, or is there a little more to the story?
No, I think that is a correct assessment. And I think the fact that I was put on the staff for the 68 games put me in a position, because in 1972 the selection was made by a vote of a committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that having been at the 68 games and been selected as part of that staff helped me to become one of the head coaches in 1972, which then really set off my Olympic coaching career.
Yes, sir. Well, awesome. Is there anything else that kind of stands out that we haven't touched on, or that just comes to mind that you'd like to, you know, tell us about that you think might enrich this this interview process at all?
I don't think so. I think you've covered the waterfront.
We tried. Well, I want to apologize. I called you Mr. earlier, and it's a doctor, so I apologize for that, because after I get my PhD, I'm going to make everyone call me doctor once. So
I use that title if I'm calling a physician and want to get their attention, or I'm talking to somebody in education. Then it makes a difference, otherwise it really doesn't.
Yeah, well, I just really want to thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate talking with you. It's an honor to talk to, you know, someone who's done so much and continues to do so much for the sport and is really involved in it. You know, you're giving back, and for me, that speaks volumes. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. O'Brien. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dominic, and I wish you good luck.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you later on, maybe.
PhD.
All right, thank you.
Harder today than it used to be.
We'll see.
I hope you get there.
Thank you very much. That's my plan.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.